Good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, the talk show about ideas. Little Atoms is based around ideas of the Enlightenment and actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we often end up discussing the antithesis of these ideas, things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'm Neil Denny, and it's a massive pleasure to welcome back for, I think, 1 week only at the moment, ex-presenter and co-founder of the show, Richard Sanderson. And Richard's going to introduce our guest this evening, Jim Baggett.
Well, thanks a lot, Neil. I'm hoping that 20 months of childcare, which is basically why I've been away, I hope it hasn't blunted my intellect as much as I fear it has, but we shall see. Yes, you're listening to Little Atoms, and our guest is Jim Baggett. Jim Baggett has been studying and writing about the history of physics for nearly 20 years and has won awards for his scientific research and his science writing. His previous books have been widely acclaimed and include A Beginner's Guide to Reality and Beyond Measure, Modern Physics, Philosophy and the Meaning of Quantum Theory, which was described as doing for quantum theory what Hawking's A Brief History of Time did for astronomy and cosmology. Jim's latest book is Atomic, The First War of Physics and the Secret History of the Atom Bomb, 1939 to 1949. And it's a big tome, Jim, which I've been enjoying enormously. I suppose to start off with, the thing I'd like to kick off with is the idea of when did these scientists suddenly realise the awesome power that was at their fingertips, and that it could be an awesome destructive power. Sort of changed the whole feel of the area, I imagine.
Absolutely. The physicists actually understood the scale of the energy that could be released through nuclear fission pretty much the moment that nuclear fission was discovered. It's not a particularly difficult calculation once you've realized how fission works. The amount of energy released in a single atomic event simply gets scaled up really by any amount of, in this particular case, uranium-235 that you want to imagine. And it would have been very easy for the physicists of the time in Christmas 1938 to calculate that a kilogram of uranium would release energy equivalent to about 20,000 tons of TNT. So the awesomeness, the destructive potential of nuclear fission was known right from the moment of its discovery. Of course, it's a completely different thing translating that knowledge into then any kind of practical device that could be used. But, of course, it's one of those fateful quirks of fate that the discovery of fission coincided literally with the rise of Hitler, Nazi Germany, and the opening stages of the war.
There was obviously initially the idea that the energy released by the atom could be used for power, what we now know as nuclear power. And then how did that develop into the idea that it could be used as a bomb?
Well, in actual fact, right again from the very, very beginning, because of the coincidence in timing, because this discovery was made literally months before the beginnings of the Second World War, the focus of all thinking, by and large, virtually from the beginning, was on a bomb. It was really on a destructive release of this awesome power. And in actual fact, the world's first nuclear reactors came into being not as sources of energy, but as huge cooking pots, really, designed to breed plutonium. Once plutonium was discovered to be a little bit more fissile than uranium-235, it had this advantage of being easily separated from uranium itself. Yes, indeed, the world's first large-scale reactors were built purely for that purpose. And it was really only after the end of the Second World War that the idea of actually building reactors for peaceful power generation purposes was really developed.
It's interesting as well, because in your book, obviously, the character of Heisenberg, who comes up a lot, and he, at the end of the war, he almost sort of cops out and says, well, we were actually working on it as a source of power. It was the nasty Americans who were building a bomb. How accurate was that?
It's very difficult to read the historical record. And in fact, of course, this was the basis of Michael Frayn's famous stage play, Copenhagen, which was based around a kind of hypothetical ghostly meeting between Bohr and Heisenberg, which mimicked the famous meeting that took place in September 1941 in Nazi-occupied Copenhagen. The issue was that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that indeed Heisenberg was very much a leading light in the German atomic program. I hesitate to really to call it a Nazi atomic weapons program, although of course that's you know, largely what it was. Mm-hmm. It wasn't overtly a military program, and was only in the very early stages of the Second World War was it actually run by the military, the German War Office. So Heisenberg appeared to play a very, very cagey game. A lot of leading Germans in all walks of society, I think, saw the rise of Hitler's Germany, not necessarily so much as a thing to be despised, although many did despise it, but actually as a thing that provided opportunities mm-hmm. for their own careers, their own positions in society, or whatever else it might be. And although, again, it's maybe reading too much into the historical record, I've come to terms with Heisenberg by thinking of him as one of those people who saw opportunities afforded by the German nuclear program to feather his own nest.
Was he also one of these people that thought that Nazism, in a sense, was a bit of a passing fad, and we'd get through it and come through in the other end, and then everything would be all right again?
A lot of Germans believe that. Mm. A lot of Germans obviously were dismayed by the brutality of the Hitler regime, and really did feel that it was not something that was going to be long-term sustainable, that Germans would somehow come back to their senses. And, you know, there would be a new order established that would be more acceptable, more peaceful. But Heisenberg himself was not by any stretch of the imagination a Nazi, yeah. But he was a patriot. And there's a big difference between the two. So what he did, in effect, for himself and for German science. But it's quite clear that they had opportunities in 1942 in particular to, in effect, make a case for substantial military funding for an atomic weapons program, and they backed off. They backed off for reasons that are largely obscure, but I think really it all boils down to the fact that they simply did not think a weapon was possible. Mm. At that stage in the war, the front had just opened against Russia. And although there was a lot of reprioritization having to take place because, obviously, the war against Russia was not going well, the truth was that there was a feeling that the war actually wouldn't last that long, that the Germans would be victorious. They'd conquered all of Western Europe anyway. So it was only a question of subduing the Soviet Union and the war would be over. So imagining 3-4 year scale programs, you know, was simply really beyond the reckoning. And may, in fact, not even have been favoured by those who were responsible for setting the budgets at that time in the war anyway.
I mean, we can all, I think, be extraordinarily grateful that they didn't get particularly far yeah. with their atomic weapons programme. But there were some quite interesting reasons for that, and one of that, of course, was they're relying on heavy water. And to what extent was sabotage by the Allies instrumental in halting the process?
Yes. Well, actually, listeners may actually be familiar with at least part of that story if they recall with perhaps some fondness the Hollywood Kirk Douglas mm-hmm. version of the film called The Heroes of Telemark, which told the story of an Allied commando attack against a plant in Rjukan in Norway, perched high in the fjords, very almost inaccessible sort of place. It was actually a fertilizer factory. It wasn't there to make just heavy water, but it made heavy water as a byproduct. Now, heavy water is like ordinary water, except with hydrogen atoms in H2O replaced by deuterium atoms, which are slightly heavier.
And what's its significance? Tell the listeners what the significance of heavy water is in this process.
It was discovered. If you're going to build a nuclear reactor, then what you have to do is to give neutrons that are spit out of an atom when it fragments, a uranium atom when it fragments, give them as big an opportunity as they can to go on to split other atoms. Mm-hmm. And the only way that they can do that is if you slow them down. So the atom falls apart, it spits out neutrons, it needs to then encounter, it needs to bounce off some things, deuterium oxide, heavy water, or in fact highly purified graphite also serves as a suitable moderator. This slows down the neutrons, it gives them an opportunity then to go on and fission other nuclei, mm-hmm. and you get then the beginnings of a self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction in the reactor, and then power. But at the same time you get an accumulation, as I've said before, of plutonium. So the Germans early on in their program had settled on heavy water as a moderator in their early nuclear reactors. And I think it's actually really worth remembering that the Germans were indeed the first to try to build mm-hmm. a nuclear reactor. They weren't successful, but they were at least there a year at least ahead of any Allied program. And they depended, therefore, on quantities of heavy water. The only source of it is in Europe was at this plant in Norway. And it was therefore targeted by the Allies, in particular by the Special Operations Executive in an early stage of the war, as a target for sabotage. And there was the famous raid that was successful, that in fact didn't involve any casualties, the most successful raid anyway, didn't involve any casualties. But it's certainly that repeated attempt to prevent heavy water getting through to the German program was a factor in slowing them down.
It also, bizarrely, it made them realise that they might have been onto something as well. It was considered so important.
One can argue, one of the difficulties that I think comes out in several places in the book is actually the military and political masters responsible or who knew about this program were simply incapable of believing that these were secrets that could somehow be kept. Mm. All of the physicists knew that this was straightforward physics. Once the knowledge mm-hmm. is out, if you like, any competent physicist in principle reading the literature will be able to work it out for himself. So there was always that feeling that, if we show that we're concerned, that we target these plants and prevent them, we know that there's something in this. But in actual fact, again, physicists around the world had figured this out. Physicists in Japan were aware of the possibilities, although they were unable to pursue a nuclear weapon of their own.
You mentioned the fact that people will be familiar from the Heroes of Telemark about this particular raid. What people might not be familiar with is the disastrous glider raid, Operation Freshman, which took place before this. So tell us a little about that.
That's right. The Special Operations Executive, their first plan of attack against this remote plant was to send in two gliders of airborne commandos, land them close to the plant, on what's known as the Hardanger Plateau. It's a very, very inhospitable frozen wilderness that is probably dark for 6 to 8 months a year anyway. Get them to make their way to the plant and obviously then sabotage it and somehow make their escape through neutral Sweden or something. But the raid was launched on a very, very cold night. Gliders were totally unsuitable for that terrain. And they both came down. Commandos were killed. And then those that survived were captured by the Germans and interrogated, in some cases extremely brutally. So it was clear from that failed attack that the Germans knew that the Allies were interested in halting production of heavy water at this plant, and fortified their positions.
Before we move on into the second half, and I want to talk particularly then about the Manhattan Project. People will be familiar with the idea of there's various names for these type of bombs, okay, and perhaps rather foolishly, before I read this book, I sort of presumed there were just different names for the same thing, okay, so people will have heard the name the atom bomb, the neutron bomb, and then about the idea of the thermonuclear bomb.
Yes.
But these are very different weapons,
very different devices with very different potential power. In fact, at a very, very early stage in the American physicists' thinking about the atomic bomb, it was realized, in fact, by Edward Teller and another physicist called Emil Konopinski, that, in fact, such would be the power released by nuclear fission in an atom bomb that it actually could be used to drive nuclear fusion reactions in hydrogen, fusing hydrogen mm-hmm. atoms together, giving rise to an even greater release of energy as the individual fundamental particles fuse together to form an atomic nucleus. And these are the kinds of fusion reactions that power the sun, basically. Mm-hmm. These kinds of fusion reactions can only happen in the temperatures and the pressures created in an atomic explosion. So there's no sense in having fusion reactions that are somehow independent. So build an atom bomb first, and you've in principle got the mechanism to build a fusion bomb, a hydrogen bomb, or a thermonuclear bomb. And again, it's thermonuclear because it's a nuclear reaction brought about through the extraordinary temperatures created in an atomic explosion. So there was a great pressure after the war to build fusion weapons. Oppenheimer resisted these. He was a very eloquent campaigner against the idea of building even more absurdly powerful, more destructive weapons. And his views kind of held sway until news came back to the West that the Soviet Union had succeeded in exploding its first atom bomb in August 1949. At that point, there was an instant gut reaction from the American administration under Truman that a thermonuclear weapon had to be built. And these were with us in the early 50s. And whereas the theoretical yields of atomic weapons are measured in thousands of tons of TNT, kilotons, the yields of thermonuclear weapons are measured in megatons, millions of tons. The biggest bomb ever exploded in the atmosphere was actually a Soviet weapon called the Tsar Bomber, which had a yield of 50 megatons, 50 million tons of TNT. And only that because it was limited by half. The real yield was theoretically 100 megatons, yielded by half to prevent problems of fallout.
It's awesome figures. Really,
doesn't bear thinking about. It really doesn't bear thinking about.
Well, you're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Richard Sanderson. We're talking to Jim Baggett about his book Atomic, The First War of Physics. And Jim, you mentioned we talked in the first half about the idea that the German plan to build the bomb was limited by the fact that the physicists realised very early on that it was going to be a long-term project. They saw, and there's this idea that Heisenberg's plan was that the whole thing could be retarded because he could go on claiming that it was going to take years and years to do, so it was going to be a waste of time and the war would be over. Now, the Americans, of course, came into the war considerably later than the war started. And yet, of course, as everybody knows the history of what happened, they successfully...
Yeah.
Detonated the first bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So let's talk a little bit about the Manhattan Project and how they managed to achieve that.
Well, I think it's really fair to say that the Manhattan Project really would never have happened without the British. Mm-hmm. The British were in fact quite quick to form an atomic program shortly after the beginning of the war in 1940, really precipitated by the discovery by Otto Frisch, an emigre physicist who had escaped Nazi Germany in 1933, when he discovered that, in fact, that if he were to consider only nuclear fission in pure uranium-235, then the amount of U-235 that would be required to make a bomb would be about the size of a golf ball. And once you get to those kinds of dimensions, it begins to strike you that that really is feasible. And it was only really pressure. The British were in no position in 1940, 1941. They were basically reduced to their knees by German attacks through the Blitz and whatever. It was realised that the British could simply not contemplate pushing this atomic weapons programme to conclusion. So they leaned heavily on their contacts in America politically and through networks with the physicists. And towards the end of 1942, beginning of 1943, the Manhattan Project was created, and there was in fact a delegation from Britain consisting of many emigre physicists from Germany and Hungary and other countries in Western Europe, but also many British physicists who joined the Manhattan Project. And that's the project that we know. That's a story that's quite familiar to us. But the driver, what was driving all of this work, which again many people were aware took place in Los Alamos in New Mexico, was really a great fear. If you look at the history of physics, it's difficult to conclude that the real kind of powerhouse of physics in the 1920s and 1930s was Germany. Many physicists had left, had been driven out by Hitler, but many had stayed behind, including Heisenberg. Heisenberg was a Nobel laureate. Obviously, he'd won a Nobel Prize for his discovery of the uncertainty principle. So there was a real fear that if German physicists were hard at work on this project, then Hitler would have a weapon that would effectively have no response. There was no answer to it. The idea of nuclear deterrence, in fact, I was really quite intrigued to see, was already being discussed in 1940. The idea was that these would be weapons that would be so awesome, there would be no defence against them except through threat of a weapon of your own.
And indeed, there's a part of the book where you talk about the worry that they were only going to be able to get enough uranium-235 to build one bomb.
Yes.
And in some respects, one bomb, if someone else is making a bomb, is pretty useless because it's no.
Once you've
no
used
threat.
It, you've no. if there's a retaliation, then you've no reply to that. Well, that's why indeed the discovery that plutonium could be used as a material to make an atomic weapon was actually so important to the Manhattan Project. The problem was that, okay, so there were really two problems the Manhattan Project was facing. The first was to separate enough uranium-235. It's a minor isotope. Naturally occurring uranium is mostly uranium-238. It's got three extra neutrons in its nucleus. So getting those separated is a tremendous task. Facilities were built in Tennessee that really, these were some of the largest buildings in the world at the time they were constructed in 1943, 1944, just to create enough uranium-235 for the weapon that was dropped on Hiroshima. But with plutonium, the issue was a subtly different one. Plutonium, the way that that's created in a nuclear reactor, means that it's created with an unstable isotope that is only one neutron different from plutonium-239, which is the key. And therefore, in order to make an effective bomb, it was necessary to develop an implosion mechanism to literally crush a ball of plutonium in on itself to create the kind of densities needed to create then nuclear fission in plutonium. And that was a major, major task. It took most of the Manhattan Project's resources to crack that problem.
This is the idea of... Let's talk about what the major difficulty is of creating an implosion, which is the...
It's actually fairly obvious. If you imagine that what you've got to do is you've got to drive, you've got to create a shockwave that drives a sphere in on itself in order to create the kind of conditions necessary to produce fission in a weapon of that kind. That shockwave has to be near perfectly spherical. So those explosions have to go off all around a sphere that drives the force uniformly inwards to the center. And the kinds of technologies, explosive technologies, simply weren't that developed at that time in the Second World War. And it was actually a British physicist, James Took, who realized that the clue to cracking this problem was to use what are known as shaped charges. These are charges with the explosive almost formed in layers, that as the explosion burns its way through the charge, it actually concentrates the force of the explosion inwards towards a focus point. And it was the development of that kind of technology that ultimately led to what we've seen, again, those who've watched documentaries have seen. The first atomic explosion was conducted at Alamogordo test site in New Mexico. It was a bomb called Fat Man. And it was called Fat Man because it was a big round bomb, and that was a plutonium implosion bomb. And it had to be tested because the technology was just so new, it was also uncertain. Interestingly, the bomb actually dropped on Hiroshima was a uranium-235 bomb, and the physicists were so confident that would work, they didn't need to test it.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I was going to ask what the percentage was, roughly, that they knew it was going to work, because it hadn't been tested. They were just going to... Were they sort of prepared to just fly home
there was this nagging doubt, this nagging fear that if they dropped this and it was a dud, then that would all be very embarrassing. They'd spent $2 billion building these weapons, and that would be embarrassing. But the point was that the uranium-235 bomb mechanism is extremely simple. You create nuclear fission when you create a supercritical mass of this material, and you do it simply by firing one slug of uranium-235 into another. Keep them apart. The bomb is safe, put them together by firing them at one another, and the bomb explodes. So, you know, this was relatively unsophisticated technology. The implosion mechanism, however, was much more difficult, and that's hence. Also, there was a luxury. You had the luxury that you could create enough plutonium by then to afford a test, and then still have more plutonium to build other bombs. There simply wasn't enough uranium-235 to make a test.
We're quickly running out of time. So what I wanted to talk about was leaving the Second World War behind and going on into the Cold War, yep. and then what becomes the standoff between the US and the USSR to develop, you know, there's a standoff between the two. And I want to talk about this idea that how much of the USSR's race to build the atom bomb was helped by espionage and spies in the American program.
Yeah. Well, I for me, writing this book was a fantastic learning experience. I learned some astounding things about the origins of the early Cold War, but also about the way that the espionage activities were actually ultimately uncovered by the American administration. It's probably too long a story now to go over that in the time remaining, but it is a fascinating piece of spy history for those.
And it's an undercurrent that runs right through the book.
Absolutely.
And it's, as you say, it's an utterly fascinating and
absolutely.
At times an utterly bizarre story.
Yes.
I mean, some of these characters are very, very strange.
Very larger than life. I mean, what drew me to write this, just to go off quickly on an aside, was there are plenty of books out there. There's books about the Manhattan Project, biographies of Oppenheimer, biographies of Heisenberg, stories of Klaus Fuchs and his spying activities. There's been recent material that have come out of Soviet archives as a result, obviously, 20 years ago of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Soviet spies have been rushing to tell their story. And there are many books now that allow you to put the pieces together. And I was very conscious of the fact that there was no one book that somehow pulled all of this together and told it as a continuous story. And that's what really drove me to put the book together the way I have. But in researching that. So we've had the situation where the war has ended with the bombs in 1945. Already the Cold War was brewing long before that moment. And in fact, in many ways, there's an argument, quite a strong argument, that says the bombs were dropped quite simply to keep the Soviets out of Japan and to prevent them from making any further headway in the Far East. So you've got the beginnings of a standoff. Stalin was decidedly unnerved by the fact that the Americans had these weapons and was intent that the Soviets would have one as well, would have an arsenal in due course. And there's absolutely no doubt that the espionage materials that have been gathered by spies, not just Fuchs, but also a guy called Theodore Hall, a young idealistic American physicist working at Los Alamos, they helped enormously in leading ultimately to the first Soviet explosion, which took place, as I said, in August 1949, only 4 years after the end of the war. The reason it actually even took that long was, of course, it's again one thing to know how it works and to be shown that it works. It's another thing that to build the huge industries that are required to create the materials to make an atomic weapon.
Jim, it's a big book. It's got a fascinating story in it. And as I say, there's an amazing undertow about spying in it as well. But unfortunately, we have a short program, so I'm afraid we're probably going to have to wind up there, Neil.
Yeah, but I would say that, as Vish just said, it's an absolutely stonking book, and it's got everything. It's got theoretical physics, it's got history, but it's also a fantastic spy story and a great narrative about the war. So it's called Atomic, the First War Against Physics, the First War of Physics, I beg your pardon. And it's from Icon Books, so this is definitely one for Christmas. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week for one more show before Christmas.
Thank you very much.